All right, we're back. Hello, welcome. Welcome to the WWCR audience out there and around the world. This is Zeph Daniel, and today we are right mid-talk, mid-interview, mid-educational update, mid-geopolitical crisis with Webster Tarpley. If you have a computer, you may go to tarpley.net, and you may also click over to waronfreedom.org. You may also hear Webster Tarpley on his groundbreaking show, and he's in at RBN, rbnlive.com, each Saturday from 4 to 6 Eastern Time. And the book, 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Webster Griffin Tarpley. This is one of those materials that's so dangerous. You look at this and you go, could this book really, and other things like videotapes, bring down an entire regime? We're going to find out right now. I had something I had to play here, a little commercial, but I don't know where it went. So I'm going to get right back. I'm sorry. You know what? I am doing the engineering here. Welcome, Webster. Welcome, Frankie. All right.
And I'm at Borders here. They have 25 of 9/11 Roads to Synthetic Terror in stock at the warehouse. Right. You have to order it. It takes a week to get it in. I just ordered my copy. $17.95 retail.
And or go to John Leonard's site, waronfreedom.org, and that's another place where you
can
get...
You can also go to Amazon.com. Amazon.com gives you the 9/11 Synthetic Terror Made in USA, along with my 1992 biography of Bush the Elder,
yes,
which played a role in the 1992 campaign. They give you the two of those, I think, for around $25, maybe a few dollars more, but they also give you free shipping if you're someplace where these other paths are not so easy.
650-page book.
Unfortunately, though,
your other
book was out of print, apparently, the George Bush Unauthorized Biography of 1992. So.
But it has been now reprinted in the fall of 2004, and that is selling quite well. That's between, it ranks sometimes, some places between 5 or 6,000 on Amazon sometimes, which is a good ranking.
Borders was unable to order that. They do not stock that particular
It's
book,
infamous, so. This book. He's being a little modest here. This book is like the Band in Boston. Sorry, Frankie. But it's one of those Band in Boston books.
No, not at all. You know, one of the...
Frankie being in Boston.
I wanted
Congratulations.
To
Congratulations. That's a good place to be.
I don't know if he likes... Frankie, how's Boston treating you, man?
You know, the weather's a little better than yesterday.
Okay.
So we'll leave it at that.
And moving right along.
I very much prefer D.C. where Webster's at. That's a lovely place. I love D.C. Yeah. It's so nice down there.
Yeah, you and Frankie have that in common. He really likes D.C. He's just a D.C. kind of guy.
What's your agenda down there, Webster? Do you live in D.C. or...
I'm a little bit north of the city, and I'm a writer, and I try to keep up with what's happening. And naturally, I scramble with all kinds of odd jobs to make a buck, as I guess those of us who are not servants of the regime have to do. Maybe we get back down to the dollar, though, because this is going on all around us. In the past couple of weeks, Syria has also dumped the dollar. And Syria is the ally of Iran. And that brings us to the big threat, which is this Iranian oil bourse, which was supposed to open on March 20th, which has been delayed by various kinds of, I think, technical difficulties, political difficulties that the U.S. and the British have thrown up. Remember that this would be the first open market or exchange or bourse since 1945, really, where you could buy oil for a currency other than the dollar. It would be the euro. Since the end of the Second World War, the rule has been, if you want oil, you must have dollars, meaning that whoever controls the dollars, i.e. the U.S. Federal Reserve and Treasury and the London Euro dollar market, if they have the dollars, they control the oil, and it doesn't matter so much who nominally or seems to own the oil. It's really in the pocket of the U.S. and the British, and this, of course, has been another way to create completely artificial demand for dollars by saying, if you want to buy oil from Iran or Saudi Arabia or Indonesia, you've got to have dollars. That's the only way. That means that there's a tremendous demand for dollars that otherwise wouldn't be there. Let's the U.S. and the British skim about 5 or 10% off the top of every one of those transactions and gives them tremendous political clout. That's the point of having a reserve currency. Remember that the reserve currency is, in essence, world domination. The British Empire, the greatest empire the world has ever seen, is based on the British pound and the British gold market. From about 1815, it went into crisis with World War I. By 1931, it was a dead letter, and the last vestiges of British monetary supremacy died out in the 1950s and 60s. The last straw was when Saudi Arabia said, no more pounds, only dollars. And if you look back at that time that I've just mentioned, 1914 to 1945 in particular, then you see that the change of a reserve currency is one of the most cataclysmic events that can take place in the world. And it was accompanied then by two world wars, communism, fascism, and a world depression, and the beginnings of a Cold War. So we're now in that same kind of geometry of world history. The dollar is going down. The Iranian oil bourse is coming. It is real. There's a complete news blackout in the U.S. and British press, but the preparations go on. Obviously, the U.S. and the British would like to have sanctions imposed on the economic front, because if you had those, then that would be another way to stymie and hobble the growth of this Iranian oil bourse. But I think it is an idea whose time has come. Now, the other side of it is something called the yen carry trade, or the Japanese 0% interest system. And
which
I don't know what that is.
Took down the is it Finland or the Icelandic currency? They
Iceland, exactly. Very good. The idea with this is just the following, that the entire Japanese economy has been run over the past 4 to 5 years as a huge support operation for the U.S. dollar. In other words, the yen is a much harder currency still today than the bloated and moribund dollar. So if you just had the yen and the dollar, everybody would say, well, I'll take the yen. So Japanese monetary authorities, under pressure from the U.S., under geopolitical blackmail, including because of North Korea, the U.S. line is, you give us what we want on the monetary front, or we'll feed you to North Korea, or wonderful things like this. So the Japanese were lending money at 0%. Now, what it meant then was that if you were a bank, you could go to the Bank of Japan, borrow money for 0%, and then take it to Iceland precisely, and lock in 10% on Icelandic bonds. The problem is now that Japan is coming to the end of the 0% road after 4 or 5 years, and it means that that huge support operation, that huge creation of demand for dollars, is ending. Because every time you got yen, you didn't keep it in yen because the interest rates were so low. You took it right out of the yen and into the dollar so you could lock in those rates. So that's ending. And the Japanese have announced as of the end of February that they will start charging interest again. They're going to go above zero. And that is going to bring down, I think, a significant part of the world monetary house of cards. And as Frank was saying, the way that this started, it emerged at the end of February. Iceland became the first country to go into crisis. Now, you got to think of Iceland as something different than just a piece of real estate up in the Arctic region with volcanoes. Think of it more like the Cayman Islands or the Bahamas. It's an offshore banking center. It's a hot money center. They have some banks. They have some insurance companies. They have this currency unit called the krona. And the Icelandic krona has declined 16% just since the end of February. And there are rumors that the main bank in the country is simply insolvent and is going to be bankrupt soon, although the government is trying to shore it up. That was the end of February. During the month of March, we've had a stock market crisis in all of the Gulf states, in Kuwait, in the United Arab Emirates, with Bush's dear friend, the Emir of Dubai, taking it on the chin. In Saudi Arabia, which is the biggest one of these, and in Egypt. So you've had a stock market crisis rolling through all of those areas, 20 to 30 to 40% declines in the stock market in a period of just a couple of weeks. At this point, New Zealand is in the tank. The country that's now under the gun of crisis is New Zealand. Their currency has declined 9%. These currencies, both Iceland and New Zealand, are at 22-month lows, and they've had very severe falls. The idea being that that hot money that was coming in from Japan just isn't there anymore. They were bubbles, and when you run out of buyers, 0% buyers from Japan, then the stuff is going to go down. So the banking systems, the bond markets, and then the stock markets, too, of these countries are in the tank. So everybody's looking ahead to see who's going to be next. The candidates for being next are emerging markets, places like Russia, India, Hungary, South Africa, Turkey, and so forth. And what's going on here, it's not a crisis of these countries. It's a crisis of the dollar system itself. It's the breakdown crisis, the death agony of the U.S. dollar. And we will reach at some point in the near future, I believe, the moment of dollar panic, the moment of the rush for the exits. And that will be when places like Japan and China, with each of them sitting on $1 trillion of U.S. Treasury securities and another $2 trillion spread through the rest of the world, they're going to say, wait a minute, we can't take these losses. The risk is too great. We're going to start trading in our Treasury securities. They're going to go to helicopter Ben Bernanke, the new head of the Federal Reserve.
Helicopter, that's funny.
They called him Helicopter Ben because he said, he once gave a speech where he said, we would never have a crash like the 1920s, 1929 to 1930s, because today we know how to do things. We would just flood the system with money. Why? Mm. We would take helicopters and drop bundles of cash on people's lawns, and then they'd go out and spend it, and we'd get out of a depression that way.
Well, and we could also shut down global trade, too, by eliminating the oil, because without shipping, there's nothing that's going to happen. Lester, I had a question about the Japanese, because they've outsourced most of their high-tech manufacturing to China as well. So isn't there some cross-currency flow of Japanese money through China? And that's very interesting, though.
The Japanese economy reached its peak around 1985, 1986, was the post-war best time that they've had. And since then, they have been prevailed upon, this goes back to ancient history, like the Plaza Accord and a few other things. They've given in to monetary manipulations dictated by the U.S., the goal always being to mask the inherent weakness of the dollar by making the yen artificially weak. And then they've gotten into all the stuff that you say, the offshore investment and so forth. Fact is, though, they do have a trillion. If they come to helicopter Ben Bernanke one morning and say, here, we have $100 billion, like one-tenth of their stash. We have $100 billion. We want cash for that because we're going to get out of the dollar. That would be very, very serious. You notice that helicopter Ben has got the situation set up now so that this data series called M3.
You don't see it.
It's no longer published. And M3 is if you have a huge monetization of debt, in other words, the Japanese and the Chinese or others, coming in to the Federal Reserve and saying, look, we didn't want to put these on the market because it would cause a panic, and that would hurt us, too. Mm-hmm. We want you to cash these in here in the back room after hours. That would not show up in M3. So the only place it would show up is in incipient hyperinflation. In other words, the beginnings of a hyperinflationary wave. And I would tell people, if you see the stock market get above 12,000 or 15,000, don't get carried away. Get out. That's hyperinflation. And the things, of course, you need for hyperinflation to afford some measure of personal protection would be investment in any commodity, anything that's not paper. Could be gold, could be real estate to own something. Again, you've got to have these things in your personal, physical possession.
I remember that. The late 70s, Webster, I remember when we had that hyperinflation during the time of Jimmy Carter and interest rates were at, 18%.
That was the Volcker interest rates. These were called, and I don't want to be sacrilegious, but the Prime Minister, the Chancellor of Germany, Helmut Schmidt, says that those were the highest interest rates since the time of Jesus Christ. In other words, nobody had imposed interest rates at that level. Yeah. That was Volcker. Carter turned the government over to Volcker, 22% prime rate.
I remember that.
30 or 35% for the rest of it.
But real estate back then was going through the roof. And I remember it was right at 1980 where gold hit $800 an ounce. Now we're seeing it at $600.
Precisely.
And so is this a redo of that time?
It's much worse because somehow through various machinations, the finance people, the financiers, were able to muddle their way through the Volcker era somehow. Mm-hmm. And then we've had, after that, we've had the Greenspan era, which has been a series of bubbles. We've had the irrational exuberance bubble in the mid-90s. We had the dot-com bubble from 1999 to 2001. Housing bubble. But on top of that, the main bubble is the U.S. Treasuries bubble, the dollar bubble, the stock market bubble. So all of those are now in danger, because the idea is anything denominated in dollars is inherently a very, very dubious proposition. It's just a question of time until some incident sets off a panic, which will now be a currency crisis, a dollar panic, and create tremendous problems for this system.
Didn't we have that in 1998?
That, of course, was...
there was a meltdown long-term capital management. Was
absolutely.
That it?
Absolutely. That was these people, long-term capital management is a hedge fund in Connecticut. They were operating using the Black-Scholes model of derivative valuation. The problem with derivatives, and that there are about $400 trillion of derivatives in the world. $100 trillion just in the U.S., $50 trillion just in J.P. Morgan Chase. So there's one you want to stay away from. Nobody knows what these things are worth. So the Black and Scholes got the Nobel Prize in Economics for proposing what the derivatives were worth. The year after, or 2 years after, Russia went bankrupt. The Russian bond market, the GKO market, blew, and it turned out that with the exposure of long-term capital management, they were bankrupt to the tune of $3, $4, $5 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And the upshot of that was that the whole world banking system, everything, London, New York, Tokyo, Frankfurt, everything, was within several hours of panic crash, meltdown.
Oh, yeah.
The way that would work is you have this thing in Manhattan, Clearinghouse Interbank Payment System, CHIPS. They have to settle at the end of the day. If major banks go bankrupt, they can't settle. The entire system grinds to a halt. So that is one way that a crash could actually come, through CHIPS in New York, and the equivalent is CHAPS, the Clearinghouse Automated Payment System in London. If those two blow, then you have BOJNet, Bank of Japan, equivalent settlement system. Any one of those blow, the whole world blows, and that's then the panic is on. So we're on the verge of cataclysmic events. I would stress the cataclysmic events are not of a geological nature. There's some people say, well, it's peak oil. I would say no, it's not a geological event. It's classical political economy. It's based on investment decisions and things of this sort. We've had a series of warnings. Don't just listen to me. We have had the head of the Asian Development Bank come forward and talk about the risk of a dollar collapse and how everybody in Asia has got to get ready and insulate themselves as much as they can. I think he overestimates what could be done. But he says, we have to get ready for the risk of a dollar collapse. We've had a guy from an entity called LD Pensions in Denmark who's talking about the perspective of a global financial breakdown in the short term. Bill Gross, you may have heard of him.
Yeah, he's the bond daddy guy.
Exactly. He's the great bond guru. He's the head of PIMCO, which I guess is the biggest mutual fund that operates in the bond market. So Bill Gross of PIMCO says, right now the dollar can only go down because it has lost its carry. That's his pun on the yen carry trade, the 0% stuff that I was talking about. The FT, the Financial Times, is generally very, very worried in its editorial columns about worldwide bond market jitters. And again, the only question is which country will be the next one for this sort of meandering crisis, which again, it looks like at any given moment you'd say, my God, Iceland is going to bring down the world, or New Zealand is the key. It's none of that. It's the dollar. It's the inherent, deadly, moribund weakness of the dollar.
Which and comes from printing too much money, right?
It comes from 40 years now of absolutely insane economic policies of deindustrialization, taking down factories, steel mills. It comes from the change to a service economy, which was a piece of insanity from the word go, and then from the notion of the U.S. being the buyer of last resort, the ultimate dumping ground, which is the corollary of the service economy. If you need industrial goods, you're going to have to buy them from somebody active, whether it's Japan or South Korea or Thailand or China. And then the monetary machinations, in other words, the leveraged buyout era, the bubble era that we've been through with Greenspan, above all, derivatives, $400 trillion.
So you're saying, Webster, so any one event could, is it trigger, if there, I understand that if, say, gold goes up too much too fast, it could trigger a derivative meltdown, and that could then bring down the world. What about derivatives, and how dangerous are they right now?
Well, with derivatives, you've got forms of speculation that were hardly known 30 or 40 years ago, although there are historical precedents going way back for some of this derivative stuff in Holland and elsewhere. The derivatives, they contrast to the normal things in the following way. If you have a bond gives you a hold on the assets of a corporation. If you have a stock is a part ownership in a corporation. But if you have a derivative, if you have an option, a future, and then all of the huge, endless world of exotic variations on this, right? The we could go reel off.
Well, but someone said that the derivative is a debt on a debt. Is there any?
It's instead of being paper based on something real allegedly, yeah. It's paper based on you don't know what.
Yeah, so it's got this sort of weird kind of voodoo thing out there. So it's something that could bite us, but no one knows exactly how or when or where it lurks.
It is that when bankruptcy strikes, as in the case of long-term capital management,
right? That was overnight.
A tremendous amount of money to unwind, as they say, unwind the derivative position.
And I remember Greenspan; he immediately gave him like $300 or $400 million right off the bat, which he's not supposed to do. They made an exception because of the danger to the world security.
Exactly. So, to save the banking system, it also helped that one of the members, I think, of the long-term capital management board had been an official of the Federal Reserve and therefore a crony of Greenspan. So it was a crony backdoor bailout, and it got into the billions within a couple of days, expanded the money supply.
Yeah, it started as $300 or $400 million, then it went up.
It's similar to things that they did back in the Mexico bankruptcy of 94.
Exactly, I remember. Yeah, right.
We also had Barings Bank blow. We had, and then of course the Asian contagion. It's a misnomer because it's a dollar contagion. That was also a crisis. That was a crisis of disequilibrium between the Japanese yen and the U.S. dollar, and what that did to these countries. But it was a dollar crisis. This one is much more serious because look at the dollar position, a $9 trillion national debt.
Yes.
And an $800 billion yearly balance of payments, that is the current account deficit, balance of payments deficit, almost $1 trillion per year. The U.S. now has to borrow at the rate of $2.2 billion per day to make up for this. Every other country in the world, if they want to buy something, they've got to have exports, sell something to somebody, earn foreign exchange, use that money to buy what you want. U.S. doesn't do that. Just we have the right, print the money, and it eventually leads to tremendous overhang in the hands of foreign investors, and they're going to get nervous, and then they're going to dump it. And it's just that simple. The only question is when and how. Any tremor, and it could be outside of the economic realm. It could be, a plane crash with Britney Spears on board and panic results. Something absolutely crazy.
Another Charlie Sheen appearance. And that would be
Suppose Bush is taken to the hospital with an undiagnosed ailment. Anything that creates instability.
So I think I'm getting this now. What has happened is 2 years ago, pretty much anybody with a local bank has noticed that their bank is now owned by a bigger bank. And I looked at all these bank mergers that went on 2 years ago, and it was always the insolvent J.P. Morgan at the top, and the little solvent one with real property and real assets underneath it that got absorbed. But now I guess they ran out of that, so what they're doing is running around crashing other economies, such as Iceland, Argentina, and taking their money, right? Is that what's going on?
It's definitely a part of it. This is a looting system. The rate of return on dollar-denominated paper is how much loot can you squeeze out? And they were trying to squeeze Argentina, right? In 2001, Argentina said, sorry, debt moratorium. And that's, of course, that would be Chapter 11 bankruptcy for a place like Argentina. What we need, I would say, at this point is a worldwide Chapter 11 bankruptcy. That is a freeze on all international financial payments. Freeze them, put them aside for the duration of the crisis, but don't let this colossal debt burden, which is worldwide because of the nature of the dollar system under which it's been accumulated, freeze all that, set it aside, don't let that prevent the recovery. As you're saying, there's cartelization of everything. I remember 1996, 10 years ago, it was actually, J.P. Morgan, what we call J.P. Morgan Chase today, is the Chase Manhattan Bank that was acquired by Chemical Bank, meaning Chemical Bank New York Trust, in the mid-90s, and that's this huge J.P. Morgan Chase, is the confluence historically of about 25 or 30 banks that names have been dropped along the way. If you look at the oil industry, you've got this tremendous cartelization, right? It's now, you know, Exxon Mobil and so on down the line, right? It's Texaco BP, I guess it is, and on and on. So you're dealing with everything cartelized. In the old days, there used to be always the promise that you had the East Bloc, Soviet sphere, and that you could loot that. Well, now that's been looted. China is looted to the extent that the authorities will allow. So we're running out of opportunities for what is called primitive accumulation, looting of the rest of the world. And that means that, again, the dollar system does not finance hard commodity production. It does not finance investment in new capital equipment, infrastructure, doesn't create new jobs. It's literally a dying system. I would compare it most closely to the Spanish Empire in the late 1500s, the early 1600s, where they've been completely hollowed out by always importing. They get free silver from Peru, use that to buy what they want, let their industries go to seed, right, go to pot, and then ultimately they crash. Oh, they're quite
where
a few decades.
Ultimately, everyone, they went around looting gold by being an imperialist conqueror. And eventually, everyone in Spain had so much gold they didn't want any more of it. You know, no one would go to work. I've already got it.
And they didn't
want
to work. And they used to have a textile industry, and they lost it completely. So that, I think that's the U.S. The Anglo-American system does not do it usually through military conquest. The neocons want to bring in the military conquest more directly. But the U.S. and the British system that we have today is essentially doing the same thing. And it has reached the end of its rope. For the Spanish, they had several decades where they seemed to be militarily invulnerable, and then all of a sudden they collapsed. And that's the other thing. Any significant military defeat for the U.S., right? If a warship gets sunk somewhere in the world, or some position in Iraq collapses and gets overrun with heavy losses, that could also be the thing that would bring down the dollar, because it would cause a panic in the ability of the U.S. and the British to enforce their dictates in any realm. And of course, the reason that most people stay in the dollar now is not out of love for the dollar and not out of the love for the losses they're accumulating, but because they know that if they dump the dollar, they'll be declared to be terrorists, because that's what happened to Saddam Hussein, that's what happened to Iran today.
And now we're
like Venezuela,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, now we're getting around to the real issue here, which is this idea of this bully thuggery, this idea that when you were here last, Webster, you talked about how if this regime goes down, they might want to take a lot of people with them.
Maybe we should. I think we have to talk about this too, and I think these things are absolutely chilling. Just on Iran, we have a guy called Sirin Sioni, mm-hmm. is one of the bosses of the Carnegie Endowment. And he says he's in constant contact with the Bush White House, and he says for a long time he did not believe that an attack on Iran was in preparation. And he now says his contacts, this is as of the last couple of days of March, he says, my contacts with the White House now indicate that there's a strong desire in the White House to hit Iran. And you can see why. In other words, the Cheney doctrine from last summer is there's going to be a new 9/11. It's going to be blamed on Iran automatically,
right.
And it will be the basis of an atomic attack on Iran, and that's the perspective under which these people have been working, and it has a wag the dog component, of course. It gets the the crumbling of the Bush administration off the front page. So Sirincione, that's an interesting piece of evidence. And we also have various Russians talking continuously about the fact that a U.S. sneak attack on Iran is in the offing. Now, the biggest thing here, you have to look at foreign affairs. The I guess it comes out every 2 months.
It's
the House organ
quarterly, I think,
of the Council on Foreign Relations. So the Council on Foreign Relations is a group of bankers, financiers, and other luminaries in New York City, and it is it's the point where the geopolitical thinkers and the banking community meet. I never thought that this was a place where the general line of the ruling class was made up, but it is one important place where the general line of the ruling class gets presented to the rank-and-file members of the ruling class.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the current edition, there is an article in there about nuclear first strike. It's called The Return of U.S. Nuclear Preeminence. And it essentially says, since about the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, 40 years ago and more, we had a position of mutually assured destruction. It was clear that if the U.S. attempted a first strike on the Soviet Union or Russia, the response to that would be a crushing counterblow that would inflict unacceptable losses. And similarly, if Russia, Soviet Union tried that on the U.S. and the West, similar outcome.
Mm-hmm.
What these two authors say now, they're two academics, one of them from Notre Dame. I just don't have the paper in front of me.
Okay, Webster, let me take a little break here,
okay.
And just because we're right at another point where there's another leg here of getting, you know, bringing it. I want to bring it back around into, you know, the people listening and how what they're facing. You know, the average everyday working person out there that's
okay.
Doesn't have time to really, you know, bring it down into a personal level. And Frankie, stay right there. We're going to take a little break, folks. This is Channel Z, Zeph Daniel with Frankie Riding Shotgun, Trish, and Webster Tarpley. And by the way, everybody, on waronfreedom.org, you can get 24 copies of 9/11 synthetic terror, including shipping, for $180 at $7.50 each, free shipping, 60% discount. Buy a box. Wow. I think I'm going to do that. I'm going to buy a box of those.
Please do.
All right.
The Zeph Report on WWCR, non-corporatized, listener-supported radio. Help us grow and stay on the air by sending your support to 5 Bisbee Court, 109 Box 16, Santa Fe, New Mexico, 87508. If you're online, fast small donations can be made at zeph.us. That's zeph.us. Are you timid, busy, just plain mad, and want to take a jab at the dark side but don't know what to do? Without a doubt, your check to 5 BISBE Court, 109, Box 16, Santa Fe, New Mexico, 87508.
All right, yeah, a little station ID and a chance to pay a few bills, but like I said, this box of 24 copies, had I known it was such a great deal, I would have gotten them. What I'm going to do is have a Webster Tarpley day where I give them away to callers, but, I mean, you can't beat that deal. I welcome back now Webster Tarpley. Thank you for being here. This is eye-popping, ear-popping, and everything else popping, and you know what you've done? You've given me... in a strange way, I feel better today. I started off in a really bad mood. I mean, the last couple of days, I've been in a real funk. You know, I've just been feeling all this, what you're talking about. But to hear you talk about it, it's like, oh, it makes sense now.
It also makes sense that April is the cruelest month for some reason.
March is pretty bad going out, and then that first week of April, I mean, there was a day where Frankie and I couldn't even get it, you know, out of our beds. We wandered to the microphone going, are they spraying something on? Is something going on, or is this just a general mood of the country? What's happening? And, you know, but I do feel an ominous, when you were talking, Webster, I'll just say the feeling I had fall of 2006, September, October, that time for that financial flu season to kick in.
Well, October is traditionally the month when they have to do the end of third quarter balance sheets, and that's when things sometimes blow. But even more immediately, this question of the nuclear first strike, the article, and
yes.
I urge people to read this because this is absolutely chilling. Foreign Affairs, the issue is March-April 06. It's called The Rise of U.S. Nuclear Primacy by Keir A. Lieber, L-I-E-B-E-R, and Daryl G. Press, P-R-E-S-S. One of them, let's see, Lieber is from Notre Dame, Daryl G. Press, University of Pennsylvania, and they're telling you that the Russian nuclear deterrent is now decaying. It's collapsing, they say. It has been radically cut in all three of its legs in terms of the strategic bombers, land-based missiles, submarine-launched ballistic missiles. And they say China has a very small and slowly expanding nuclear deterrent. Just on the Russians, they say Russia now has 39% fewer long-range bombers, 58% fewer ICBMs, and 80% fewer SSBNs than the Soviet Union did. And their conclusion on the Chinese is that they have only 18 missiles. Russia has only two nuclear submarines left, and they go on and on in this vein. And the idea is, here's their thesis. They say, quote, "It will probably soon be possible for the United States to destroy the long-range nuclear arsenals of Russia or China with a first strike. This is caused by the improvements on the U.S. side, the precipitous decline of Russia's arsenal, and the glacial pace of modernization of China's nuclear forces." And they say the world is therefore going to live in the shadow of U.S. nuclear primacy for many years to come. I consider this to be a document of absolute insanity, courting developments that can only be described as apocalyptic, written by, undoubtedly these are neocons. They have to take into account, which they don't, that even though the overall profile of the Russian nuclear deterrent has decayed, obviously with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Putin government has made sure that Russia has maintained world superiority in certain kinds of missiles. Putin, last year, announced that he had a new kind of intercontinental ballistic missile which could defeat any known form of Star Wars anti-ballistic missile nuclear defense. And the Russians also have forms of cruise missiles, the Sunburn missile and a few others, which are better than anything in the West. So even though you'd say, well, the great tank armies of the Soviet Union are long gone, military establishment is shrinking, that should not mask for us the idea that within that there are areas where the Soviets, Russia, have actually improved their ability. And in the case of the Chinese, there may be much more to it than these two academics think. In other words, they are making the characteristic fatal neocon mistake of underestimating their adversaries, thinking that they can't do anything. Remember, we were hurt. We were told that the attack on Iraq would be a cakewalk.
Yeah.
That's bad enough. Now we're told,
bring it on. Remember this. Bring it on. Bring it on.
We're now told that worldwide thermonuclear war against Russia and China is yet another cakewalk.
It's
and
winnable.
This time, you can wake up in the day after. You can wake up in an apocalyptic nightmare world of nuclear missiles raining down because these insane neocons, these people ought to be in the loony bin. There's just nothing to be said about these guys.
That's not funny, but
they are raving. They're like Hitler in the bunker in terms of their mentality. So,
well, apparently, Cheney's personality has infected quite a few people underneath the White House there that hang out down in that bunker.
Well, could it be though that they're looking at this economic cataclysm? Because if the dollar becomes unconvertible and useless, the American people are going to be starving in the streets. I mean, could they be looking at this and making
depopulation? Depopulation.
Clearly, the potential of the dollar crisis and the associated financial crisis is something like the dislocations of not even the stock market crash of 1929, because that's not the main thing. The main thing is what happened after September 1931, when the British went off the gold standard, when the Bank of England defaulted on gold payment, that was, for the many financiers, the end of the world. There used to be a proverb, as safe as the Bank of England. You haven't heard that in quite a long time.
The
change came in 1931. When the British defaulted on gold, that meant that the gold panic hit the U.S., and then we had this banking panic here in the United States. From 1931 to the coming of Roosevelt in 1933, every bank in the United States closed its doors without exception, and they were all bankrupt, all insolvent, panic runs on every one of them. And it was only Roosevelt's determined action that was able to save the U.S. from a breakdown of the social fabric in general. In other words, an extreme, exacerbated breakdown crisis. So that's exactly
so they
what's
can't
possible.
Blame the government. Yeah, so when you weaken the people so much, they can't blame the government. If you attack the people in the aftermath, or you create a terror situation where we've been horribly attacked, and so we're going to suffer losses, and the banks are going to be shut down, so therefore stand behind your government, let's go get those bastards that ruined us, or whatever. What about that kind of scenario, too?
Well, obviously, I think that the financiers in New York and London have the responsibility, and they should pay for the depression. This depression depressions are expensive, right? It's $5 to $10 trillion. What we should be thinking about right now, the tremendous number of problems on the plate, and I just want to give this as a small example of what could be done. You probably pay in most states sales tax for sure of 5, 4, 5, 6, 7%. In many states, you pay that on your groceries and when you go to the supermarket. Now, here in Maryland, we don't have to pay the sales tax on groceries. Over here in Virginia, you do, and I leave it to the listeners to figure out what's happening where they are. There is an income stream. It's the one that goes through Lower Manhattan every day. That is quadrillions of dollars per year. Not one penny of taxes is paid on that. Let's say, don't you think it would be fair, since we have to pay a 5% sales tax when we buy something, that if a finance oligarch wants to wheel and deal derivatives, he should pay 1% on the dollar? How about even less? How about 1 mil, 1/10 of a penny, 1/1000th of a dollar? If you look at that, if there were $100 trillion of derivatives going through Wall Street, let's have a 1 mil tax, and it gives us $100 billion of tax revenue right there.
It's amazing
that fair?
It's amazing that, well, fair doesn't really enter into this at this point. I mean, but it's amazing.
Oh, I don't know. I'm working right now, which is rare. I work in the technology industry, and I estimate the tax rate to be anywhere from between state, local, FICA. You add it up. You speak of derivatives and taxes on top of taxes. I'd say it's 50 to 70%.
Well, right, but can't we call on the finance oligarchs to pitch in and do their share? 1 mil on the dollar. I think 1% would be fully justified. If you had 1%, then out of $100 trillion in derivatives, you'd have $1 trillion of tax revenue right there to solve all of your problems. And it would establish the principle. Who should pay? Should the tax burden be shifted to illegal aliens, to the middle class, to the working poor? No. It has to be shifted to the Wall Street fat cats and financiers who have been the architects of this catastrophe and who have been riding high on the hog for all these years. Let the oligarchs pay. This is the principle of a Tobin tax. Tobin having been a well-known economist at Yale, or securities transfer tax. And it's just the beginning. It's just a little window on what you could do if you begin to have some class consciousness and think about who should bear the tax burden. Not the poor people that have been bearing it now
every
for 25 years.
When you move $100 billion from bank A to bank B, let's say, or you do a currency swap, there's always what they call a fallout. And I mean, this is a very sophisticated instrument. They use letters of credit and other things where there's this, you know, it's shavings of a penny difference that goes into somebody's pocket, like 1 or 2 cents, you know, but magnified, you know, millions and millions of times. And what happens is that money is never reported to anyone. And there's been a lot of speculation that the mob gets the money, or that, you know, criminal interests get the money, that what's called the fallout between every transaction that goes on in the world, there's a few cents that fall, you know, per dollar that falls out that doesn't add up.
There's obviously moving money from one currency to another obviously engenders commissions and costs and related things. But again,
You can get a piece of that.
For a small businessman, if you want to move, you know, 100 bushels of wheat from one place to another, that will also cost you. Let the finance oligarchs, let the New York financiers, the Wall Street interest, which is parasitical and has been so destructive and so meddling in the strategy side of things,
yes.
Let them pay something. And remember, on the other side of it, we've had this article in the Council on Foreign Relations. This past week, Putin he made a visit to the most important Russian nuclear weapons factory, and he made a speech which was obviously intended for world consumption, but somehow Bob Schieffer never quite got to it. This was one where he said, the Russian nuclear deterrent is credible, it is capable, it is the basis of world peace, it's constantly being modified and refined and technically improved, and I think he's right concerning the heart of the matter. He's got various areas of the Russian deterrent that are as good as anything in the world and possibly better than anything the U.S. has, especially in terms of those new, there are at least two new ICBMs that can't be stopped by any of this foolish Star Wars stuff that the Bush administration has been yammering about since they unilaterally denounced the ABM treaty. So
we won't be taking a first strike here. We're not going to be absorbing a first strike. We're going to be the first strike now. We are the author of the first strike.
Well,
at this point.
But if you look at this rise of U.S. nuclear primacy by Lieberman Press,
yes.
If I were a third world leader reading that, I would say, well, this doctrine being ventilated here in the foreign affairs means that if I get into a crisis with the U.S., I better do the first strike. I'll catch them on the ground if I wait for them to attack me. Indeed, they say here that the Russian, and this may be true, the Russian early defense radar has some holes in it, and if the missiles come from the Pacific, it's going to be hard for Russia to see what's coming. If I were a Russian general, I'd say, yeah, well, in that case, if you're going to hit me with a surprise attack, I'll outfox you. I'll launch first, and you can absorb the attack. And that's, what, of course, World War III.
Yeah, what? Okay, so World War III, are you saying then, Webster, that World War III could be triggered by a financial flu, a collapse of the dollar, some hiccup somewhere in the world?
I would put it in this way. I would say that from the point of view of the U.S. and British financiers,
mm-hmm.
that the situation for them is now apocalyptic. It's the Götterdämmerung, right? The twilight of the pagan gods. And
yeah.
They are now in an increasingly apocalyptic mood. The neocons like Pearl and Wolfowitz basically say, my God, Scooter Libby is indicted, Lord Conrad Black is indicted,
right.
Another very important
yeah.
neocon.
Yeah.
We may be indicted. If you give the neocon the choice between World War III and being indicted, he'll say, I'll take World War III and let the little people pay the price.
We've
so there's this mood where they're getting more and more desperate, more and more hysterical, and more looking around for some way to shore up their system. And traditionally, one way to do it is military adventures, brinksmanship, confrontation, going to the brink, and so forth. And that's where we are right now. Extremely dangerous.
Yeah, code red, martial law, you know.
Absolutely, all of that.
Getting people to turn their neighbors in and report, lining up for vaccines. Because what about, well, now that I've brought that up, let's go around to the bird flu and the flu threat. And I believe this is some kind of a manufactured thing as well. What are your thoughts on that?
I would have to say there's an objective side to all of this, which is not encouraging. In other words, long before there was the ability to manufacture this stuff, there have been pandemics, right? The,
mm-hmm.
If you go back to the Black Plague of the 1300s, the 1340s especially, you'll see that plague had been around for quite a while. The thing that was new was that Western Europe had fallen under the crushing rule of the financiers of Genoa and Venice. And the kings had been borrowing money from Genoa and Venice, and in return, the Genoese and Venetian bankers were demanding austerity measures. At one point, the Genoese and the Venetians had all of the sheep in England pledged to them as the security for a loan, and then all the sheep meadows and the entire wool production. So every time you have this, you have a crushing tax burden coming from the king to the population. You drive down the standard of living. You bring on malnutrition. You weaken the immune system. You open the door to a pandemic. I would say the phenomenon known as globalization today has done the same thing. It has put the human species as a whole into a catastrophic situation. You have to remember, there are 2 billion people in the world at less than a dollar a day, if we use a dollar from the Clinton era rather than from the Bush era, which is now even less than a dollar was then. 2 billion people scraping along at less than a dollar a day. It's clear that there's a tremendous potential for a pandemic. Think of the Spanish flu after World War One. That was an objective weakening because of the British sea blockade. Nobody in Europe had any good nutrition. These millions of people had been in trenches and so forth. Those are the sorts of things that set the stage for a pandemic. I think we're in a similar situation today. 15 years of unrestrained looting, globalization, driving down standards of living. We can see statistically the living standards in the U.S., even in the most fluffy sort of statistical series, the average family income under Bush has declined. The one you really want to watch is average weekly earnings. That has declined even more, and that has been doctored since the Botkin Commission. So we've had a continuous fall in the standard of living in this country since about 1970 or thereabouts. The current standard of living in the U.S. is one half what it was back in the Eisenhower-Kennedy years. And I think that's a very important consideration. Similarly, in other parts of the world, living standards are declining. People are getting less nutrition. There's more malnutrition. There's more breakdown of immune systems. This means that anything can come right in the door. Now, whether on top of that we also have machinations, conspiracies, bio-warfare, I think it's plausible.
Yeah, they spray stuff in the air. I know that because the people get sick after they spray.
I think that's absolutely real and absolutely plausible. The only thing I would say is whether it's going to be an artificial pandemic or a real spontaneous pandemic, we're in line for a pandemic. I mean, if you look at the Spanish flu, the Spanish flu of 1919, okay, the Asian flu of the late 50s, overdue.
But that would then affect the economy. That would also be martial law. That would be, wouldn't they get a lot of the pressure off of themselves, the oligarchs, get the pressure off by having such a pandemic?
Yes, although you might say, well, the Spanish flu of 1919 helped to make sure that there were no communist revolutions in Europe after World War One, mm-hmm, beyond the Russian one and the Hungarian one, I guess. That it's possible to look at it that way. But again, I'm always alert to conspiracies, needless to say. But on the other hand, there is objective economic and physiological reality out there,
right,
and that
true.
Is very bad. So whether it's going to be Fort Detrick, Maryland, here up the road, that's
right,
going to give you
right.
the bird flu, or whether something is going to come through normal channels, you got to be ready. So the answer is rebuild your hospital capacities. Here in Washington, D.C., they're shutting down hospital after. There'll soon be no hospitals left in the District of Columbia for about 1 million people. What we'd have to do is go back to things like the old Hill-Burton law that would say, how many hospital beds should there be per 1,000 population? And impose that as a standard and get new hospitals built or old ones reopened and to recreate an infrastructure. People like Senator Frist, the Hospital Corporation of America man,
right.
their racket has been to go around and find voluntary, nonprofit community hospitals, turn them into for-profit, or if they don't make a profit, shut them down. So he's destroyed the health infrastructure. And that's why, again, you have to think of these events, be it the monetary catastrophe and or the military strategic catastrophe, as coming in the midst of an administration that brought you the response to Katrina. So if you think about a Katrina style response to breakdown crisis and or,
lovely,
God forbid, nuclear exchange, then you can get an idea of the absolutely critical situation of humanity at this point.
That's how I feel. You put into words exactly the things that I was overwhelmed, though. I couldn't, everywhere I went, there was something that was like on a precipice, about to stop us in this civilization. In other words, we could wake up tomorrow. I've said to people, you know what? Maybe it's time to, you might die here. You know, people may die. I hate to bring that up, but if that's so, what do you have to do to die? Various people, they want to apologize to their parents, or they want to, or their children, or, you know what I mean? It's not.
Let me just say, in order to avoid all this, what can you do? The
okay.
answer to all of this is 9/11 truth. You want to paralyze Bush. You want to cut him off at the knees.
I do.
You want to attrit and erode his base.
Yes.
9/11 Truth will do the job. 9/11 Truth basically says you 35 to 40% who have bought into this terror demagogy, who are terrified, scared out of your wits based on very little information. You think that there's this Bin Laden and Al Qaeda. This is a fantastic story.
Right.
It's a pure boogeyman from the CIA, from the Defense Department. 9/11 Truth essentially cleans out not just Bush Cheney, but the whole invisible government from top to bottom. And as much of that as we can get is what we have to go for. So I would like to be able to agitate about a new world monetary system. It's just hard to go to a shopping mall and talk to somebody about how there should be a new world monetary system of the dollar, the yen, and the euro. But what you can do to people is to say, look, that rogue network, those people above and behind the Bush White House, they're the ones who brought you 9/11, not some gang of people in a cave in Afghanistan with a laptop.
I think a lot of people know that, but their attitude is that I just need to get through my life, you know what I mean, and they're reluctant to got to see somebody else rock the boat, and then they'll get on the dance floor to mix metaphors
horribly.
Well,
we have Charlie Sheen. Charlie Sheen.
Yeah, he's out there. Yeah, he's dead.
He's done more to bring down the 9/11 big lie than the whole Democratic Party. All the radical liberals, all the Noam Chomsky's, Amy Goodman,
right.
Michael Moore,
yeah, where
Greg Palast, these great heroes, they're so frightened they won't touch 9/11. Noam Chomsky is an intellectual and moral coward. And it goes for this entire left liberal crew who should have been the first ones out of the gate saying, this is a lie, this is a racist crime of the invisible rogue networks. They haven't done any of that.
Still,
along comes Charlie Sheen and he does it.
But they're still on a string where Charlie Sheen is maybe he hasn't been, his career has, maybe it's good that his career has not been on fire lately. Right, he's had a lot of time to sit around there in Malibu.
I think he's actually got a very successful television program, although I confess
I've
never seen it.
Well, then never mind. Forget that theory. But I believe that Charlie Sheen will go on. I don't think he'll get the punishment that Michael Moriarty got when he came out and put something in the New York Times a decade ago that stated about he tried to get at the New World Order and talk about the people like Janet Reno at that time and the Waco and this and that, and he never really worked again. And not that he was as big a name as Charlie Sheen, but, I mean, he tried it, you know, and he was punished.
Well, one of the building blocks in this has to be freedom of media.
1 minute, guys, 1 minute.
Freedom of media where, you know, it's not controlled by a super large mega corporation. That has to be what's taking you to the airwaves, Lester.
Well, I'm fortunate enough to have this two-hour program on rbnlive.com.
Right.
And you can tune in tomorrow, Saturday, between 4 and 6 in the afternoon, Eastern Time. Tomorrow I'm going to have as a guest David Shaler. David Shaler and Annie Machon, his wife, who they've written a book called Spies, Lies, and Whistleblowers. This is a whistleblower from MI5, the British equivalent of the FBI, and his story is, he was sitting at MI5 and he saw that his counterpart at MI6 was paying Al-Qaeda £100,000 to kill Gaddafi of Libya, the goal being to get a pretext for a U.S.-British invasion of Libya to seize the oil wells there. So it's a perfect example of how U.S.-British intelligence uses Al-Qaeda.
Okay, well, Webster, that's it. We're out of time. Go there tomorrow. Tune into Webster and you'll probably be able to get in and call in as well.
Absolutely. Call-ins are welcome.
Call in and ask him anything you want. Thank you for putting up with our questions. We sort of like, it was me and Frank at either side of you. But it's been a lot of fun. You did help me. I do feel better. Folks, this is what happens here at Channel Z. And we're going to be heading out of here. Webster, stay right there. What we're going to do now is we're going to say goodbye to y'all and have a great weekend. God bless you, each and every one of you. And don't let it get you down. Okay, I'll turn these. Don't let it get you down out there, folks, and we'll see you on the flip side. Love y'all.